An extraordinary true tale. A fortune awaits the Edwards family in both the United Kingdom and the United States if they can prove that they're the true owners of Lower Manhattan. All is revealed in Manhattan Story.
Come on in. Over here I've got a rather large case which I keep quite a lot of documents in. And if I clip it undone, there you see, an immense lot of research. Robert Edwards was an English pirate, a sea captain. This Robert Edwards was granted 77 acres, 3 rods, 32 perches of land in New York on the Hudson River by the British Crown for services rendered to the Crown.
Leonard Edwards, Joshua Edwards, John Edwards, Thomas Edwards, Martha Edwards.
Manhattan Island, June 1st, 1778. Know all men by these presents that I, Robert Edwards, on this day, leased to John and George Kruger 77 acres, 3 rods, and 32 perches, beginning at the stake set in the ground at high water mark near Bestay, and then running east along Prince Street, 1,000 foot, thence northwesterly in a zigzag course along part of Old Jan's land to Christopher Street.
Those are the words from a copy of an alleged original lease written by a certain Robert Edwards, who, according to family legend, was an 18th century Royal Naval officer of Welsh descent who left some swampy land off the east coast of America to his descendants. The land in question turned out to be a large chunk of Lower Manhattan. It has built on it one or two famous landmarks, such as Wall Street, the Stock Exchange, and the World Trade Center. Estimated value, $680 billion, and rising as we speak. The Edwards clan in both Wales and the United States have struggled against Trinity Church to prove ownership of the land. According to the Edwards family, it's a story that's involved fraud, conspiracy, deathbed confessions, and the odd mysterious death. In other words, a typical Manhattan story.
We'll take Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island too.
So what was Robert Edwards' background? Edwards' heirs attorney, John Smarto.
There were two theories, that there is a Robert Edwards that was a lieutenant with the Royal Navy at the time we're talking about. In addition to that, we have tax records from Manhattan Island that shows that Robert Edwards owned property in the Wall Street area, which is the property we're talking about, and he paid taxes on them. You can go to the Historical Society in Manhattan, and you can get a copy of that. I have a copy of that. The confusion when I first got into it was that, well, how did the Edwards get the property? Wasn't it just because of loyal service to the Crown they were granted this property? And initially I believed that because I didn't have any evidence to contradict it. However, when I looked at the Hall end of things, there's a connection between a fellow named Thomas Hall, who was a Dutch immigrant who lived on Manhattan. At the time, it was called New Amsterdam when the Dutch controlled Manhattan. And then, as you know, the British supplanted the Dutch, and it became New York. Anyway, Mr. Hall was a very prominent businessman. He was a lawyer. He had his hands in very many different types of entrepreneurial ventures. And as the story goes, Thomas Edwards, a very loyal subject of the Crown, married Mr. Hall's daughter, Elizabeth. And the theory is that part of Mr. Hall's lands that he acquired when the Dutch controlled Manhattan was conveyed or transferred to his son-in-law, Thomas, and affirmed by Governor Lovelace at the time, making that property recognized by the British government in the hands of Thomas Edwards. That's how the Hall aspect goes into it. So, technically, Robert is the son of Thomas.
The plot thickens. Edward's heir, Betty Gooch.
There were actually two estates side by side. One belonged to his father, Thomas, and the other one to Robert. Robert's land was leased to the Kruger brothers, who I understand were cousins of Robert Edwards.
And Robert is the one who entered into the famous 99-year lease with the Kruger brothers, and this property somehow never reverted back to the estate. And Trinity Church ended up occupying a lot of this property, which they deny, of course.
As the old adage goes, there are but two families in the world, the haves and the have-nots. And for many of the families descended from Robert Edwards on both sides of the Atlantic, poverty was often a common link, and so were their dreams of amassing a fortune.
My grandfather, Samuel Edwards, he said, "One day, my little girl, you are going to be a rich girl." He said, "You might be a little poor girl at the moment," he said, "and I saw you going to school in Wellington's on that sunny day the other day," he said, "but one day," he said, "you can wear golden slippers if you like, because you're going to be very rich."
My father and mother married very young. They had 17 children. I was the 15th. He farmed, worked in the coal mines. In the middle 30s, when I was old enough just to start realizing perhaps were wanting different things when you were children, and my dad would say, "Well, we can't afford it now, but one day you will have an inheritance that will, you'll be able to have anything you ever wanted." And that's what he would say, "Well, you're a poor little rich girl, and that day will come." So it was always like a fairy tale, really, to picture yourself in such a grand place. We put ourselves in more or less a Cinderella type story.
I lived at Abercorn with my grandparents most of the time, and used to sit on Grandpa's knee and be told little stories that I was a poor little rich girl, never thinking or dreaming what it meant.
My auntie Wynne was 96 and she used to live in Abercorn, and the last thing she said, that Grandpa said that she should never have to work.
And yeah. Grandpa used to say that, mine, when we were little kids, you should never have to work for a living. You were not brought up to be working people.
But then we've worked all our lives.
We're hard working people. We've worked harder than anybody in the country, I think.
I remember back in 1954, something like this, you know, your mother tells you, "Look, someday you're going to be filthy rich. You'll never have to work in your life." You know, wow, good. I worked hard all my life. I started 12 years old to earn my school clothes. I thought, wow, boy, 14 years old, I'll be a millionaire. I won't have to worry about working no more, you know. And for a boy 14 years old, you know, it was all almost like a dream.
My mother believed in it really wholeheartedly. She really thought that we'd got a chance to get this money. And I can remember my mother saying, "Well," she said, "if I ever get this money, I'm going to have my own laundry." She loved washing and ironing and things of that nature. She was going to have a laundry.
I guess my father felt that finally he could quit the coal mines. My mother would have help with the children. I wouldn't have to bake bread 3 or 4 times a week to feed the children. They could buy an automobile for transportation. It seems the Edwards' story is the struggle. It, no matter if it's here or in the UK, they were entitled to a better life.
There's a boat that's leaving soon on New York.
The alleged inheritance of the Edwards family could also be used to tempt members of the opposite sex. Beryl Thomas.
Well, I've known about this story since I was 14, when I met my husband. You can say we were childhood sweethearts, more or less. And he tried to impress me. He told me that he was 16 and he wasn't even 15. And then another thing to impress me, he told me that he was heir to the Edwards millions. Now, this at the age of 14 or 15 doesn't mean a thing. Now, I don't think he really knew a lot about it himself. It was just that he listened to the grown-up people talking, and it must have impressed him at that age. Well, anyhow, he told me now that the stock exchange was built on it. Now, the stock exchange to a young lady of 15 meant absolutely nothing at all. It might have been talking about a shed at the bottom of the garden, for all I was interested in. But then he told me that the biggest Woolworths on earth was built on this land. And suddenly my imagination conjured up all sorts of wonderful things that I'd seen in Woolworths here in Great Britain. So my whole outlook changed completely then.
For family members brought up on the so-called Manhattan fortune, it was easy to believe in the legend. But what made attorney John Smarto from Greensburg think that the story might have some basis in fact, and go against the saying that if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
You know, at the time, you're an attorney and you're practicing in the 1990s, and somebody comes to you and tells you that we own 40 or 70 acres of Manhattan Island, and I used to live in Manhattan, okay? So, we're a descendant of this fellow who was a sailor, and he came over here 250 years ago before America was even America, and we want to get the land back, or we want to get the money back, and guess what? Chase Manhattan Bank has how many billions of dollars of our money, and we need to get that from him, and things to say, a church is involved, and they're the main culprits in the whole thing. Now, this is actually the way they presented it to me, and when someone tells you it's an estate that's 250 years old, approximately, and you have to go after Trinity Church and Chase Manhattan Bank, who holds this money in some secret trust account, you don't believe that. I mean, it's beyond belief, because you feel that really, it's intellectually dishonest to talk about something like that. What really got me interested in the estate part of it is a bill that was introduced in the New York General Assembly approximately 45 years ago that would have required a commission to be set up to examine the land grants on Manhattan Island. And I read this bill. The gentleman who introduced it was an assemblyman named Van Duzer. And he had introduced the bill just to establish funding for this commission that would examine these land grants and examine the claims that these heirs have to this land. In the bill, it classifies them as the Hall Edwards heirs. This bill convinced me, because my position is that I don't think a state representative or a politician of any kind, I don't care if it's in 1998 or if it's in 1950, would go out on a limb, so to speak, or put his political reputation on the line by introducing something like this that lays out the facts and sets up a mechanism to establish whether or not the claims they're making is true. The money was never allocated for this particular bill, and therefore the bill died, as we say, died in committee.
Had the Van Duzer bill been introduced, the Edwards heirs think the truth of the matter would have been revealed. Finding the original lease by Robert Edwards has always been the holy grail for the Edwards family. It seems that in the 1920s, a certain investigator called Ralph Gibson discovered the magical document.
To Mrs. Edwards, best wishes for the new year, 1929. Dear friend, just a few lines hoping you are well and, like the rest of us, thankful for small mercies. How true it is, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. Why I repeat these two lines above is because the latest discovery to us is that after a long, trying and expensive search, the title deed left by Robert Edwards to the Manhattan Estate, New York, has at last been found. The Americans cannot touch them, nor never could, protected by the Title Guarantee Company. What's more, it is a British title, a British claim. What does the good book say? Listen, stand still, while I make your enemies your footstool.
So what happened to the lease? Betty Gooch.
In the late 1800s, up to about 1930, Ralph Gibson, from Treharris, was looking into this estate for the Edwards, and doing very well. He found those deeds. We don't know where they are now. We really do not know what happened to them. And I have a feeling that if we could find his papers, if we could find all those letters that he wrote and all the information that was in those papers, well, we might get somewhere.
An earlier document dated 1901, apparently written by a London solicitor called F.N. Glanville to an American judge called Arthur Perry, appears to reinforce Ralph Gibson's story.
My dear judge, re the Robert Edwards estate. In compliance with your instructions, I have caused a very diligent search to be made of the colonial records, touching the then American colonies from 1760 up to the time of the American Revolution, to wit, 1776. These records and documents are voluminous, and came from America in the greatest disorder and confusion.
However, after many weeks, my clerks have succeeded in finding a list of the contents of the sheepskin bags in which these documents were brought here, and we find a note of a grant from the Crown to Robert Edwards of 62 acres of land in the city of New York, given in consideration of services rendered His Majesty as a privateer in taking hostile action against His Majesty's enemies. Hence, there is no doubt that the grant itself, or a good and sufficient copy thereof, is among these documents. You must come to London yourself, or send some other capable New York lawyer to supervise this further search. I am, my dear sir, your obedient servant, F.N. Glanville.
No one knows what happened to the sheepskin bags which supposedly contained the proof that Robert Edwards really did lease parts of Manhattan. Some of the family have suggested that it was stolen to prevent the truth from being told. For well over 100 years, certain events have suggested to the Edwards heirs that they are victims of a conspiracy. A certified document allegedly containing the deathbed confession of a judge is one such example. Written in 1885, the Edwards heirs believe that it reinforces the idea of corruption in high places.
In 1887, when the Robert R.E. Edwards 99-year lease expired in New York, I told the heirs that if they would give me $250, that I would go to New York and straighten out the estate for them, and that they could pay me more once the estate was settled, and they readily trusted me. The heirs had confidence in me, they trusted me, and I betrayed them.
Trinity asserts that they never paid off anybody or contact anybody. We have come across a deathbed confession by a judge that he felt that he sold out his heirs because he took a pay off from Trinity, and then he did not acknowledge that he got the pay until his conscience got the better of him, and so he had made a deathbed confession.
They would get me even if I went into the ground. I was in hell the minute after I signed those papers and accepted that cursed money, and I have been in hell ever since.
As in most good conspiracy stories, there is often a mysterious death. Whilst the Van Duzer Bill was being prepared in the 1950s to examine who actually owned Manhattan, there was, according to Cleoma Four, one such death.
Now, J.B. Brown, who is the attorney for drafting the evidence of the Van Duzer Bill, there's evidence that he was killed.
The legend has it that he was found dead mysteriously on a train on his way to New York City. And he had all the confidential papers in his briefcase, and the briefcase was gone. Now, that's a legend. I don't know if that's true.
His death certainly is questionable. There is a couple versions. He died of food poisoning. Some say he was shot. So
I know what people say. I know how paranoid people get throughout this whole thing. I mean, in today's world, I don't, you know, you don't want to believe something like that. In those days, who knows? Who knows?
Trinity Church has been seen by many of the Edwards heirs as their main adversary. The church has been described in quite unflattering terms in the Edwards literature.
I stood on the street once more, opposite Trinity Church. Wall Street's church is very black, the absorbent black of night. It seems to be sucking all the light out of the air. It looks like a witch, crouched among the skyscrapers, a witch with a pointy hat. It looks as if it were about to spring.
Trinity Church has since been cleaned, and with its graveyard dating back to the 1690s, is in fact a haven of peace amongst the hustle and bustle of New York's commercial centre. So what does Father Calloway, representing Trinity Church, think of the Robert Edwards story? And how did Trinity Church obtain their land in the first place?
There obviously is a Hall family, and there is an Edwards family, and there was a Robert Edwards in New York. Where he was, I think, is hard to pinpoint. There is a lot of suggestion that actually his land wasn't on the west side of the city where Trinity is, but was on the east side in the area known as Beekman Street. There must be colorful exploits about the kind of person he was, and New York was a very different place then. Trinity was the first outpost of the Church of England in the new colony after it had been taken over by the English from the Dutch. And there was a desire to have an English church. However, the local populace didn't have a lot of love for the English and certainly didn't want to pay a tax to support the English church. In those days, typically the churches in the colonies were supported through public funds. So the first church was a very provisional affair. It was put up like a barn raising. Captain Kidd lent his block and tackle, and local synagogue, actually a little labor, gave money to add a tower to that church. And it was certainly a modest church. But there was this period until 1705 when Trinity really had no financial support. And then Queen Anne, we like to think of her as good Queen Anne, gave the Queen's Farm, which was a tract of real estate outside the city. Trinity was given this land as its endowment for the mission of the Church of England in the colony of New York.
Surely the Queen Anne document is convincing proof. Not so to the Edwards heirs, it seems. Edwards heirs attorney John Smarto and Cleoma Four.
I have the grant. I've read it, and I know what they received. They received the King's Farm. At the time, it was called the King's Farm. And this farm had been handed down through the generations. Depending on who was on the throne, it was either the King's Farm or the Queen's Farm. We're not talking about that land. We're talking about land that's below that. We're talking about where the World Trade Center sits today on Manhattan, all of Wall Street, all of that area down there.
We also have tax records proving that Robert Edwards did pay taxes. His land was assessed in the 7th Ward, and that is Wall Street.
None of that was ever part of this grant, and I would defy them to produce any evidence that they received that portion of their land in that grant. I'm disputing that they received the Hall Edwards lands that lie below the Trinity lands.
So the big question is, has Trinity Church ever leased land from the Edwards family?
I don't think Trinity has ever leased any land. It would be inconceivable that in leasing land that Trinity would not have gone through the protocols and the requirements that legally were required to protect the rights of leaseholders. Trinity has never owned any property on Wall Street other than the church on Broadway, which looks on Wall Street. So it's all a myth.
Many of the Edwards heirs think that the original Kruger lease is lying in a vault somewhere in the private archives of Trinity Church. Surely the story of the so-called Edwards Millions could be solved if the Edwards heirs were allowed free access to the archives. Father Calloway explains.
As you go over the claims they're making, we don't have a lease to Robert Edwards. We don't have a lease from Robert Edwards. Their coming to our archives wouldn't prove anything. But our archives have no information about a deathbed confession. They have no evidence about a murder. They cannot prove or disprove a disputed lease. If there is evidence, it is all essentially null and void because of the statute of limitations.
Now, over the past century, the Edwards heirs have brought Trinity Church to court on four occasions. Each time, the federal and New York State Court has ruled that the 15 years statute of limitation on such property claims has long since expired. The statute of limitation ensures that court time isn't wasted by old disputes, which have no living witnesses, providing fresh evidence. So would it matter if the Edwards family found their original lease?
If authentic leases were found from the colonial period, they would be null and void under statute of limitations. However many leases, if there were 1,000 leases, the statute of limitations being passed, there's no standing.
So it seems that the statute of limitation is the final nail in the coffin, preventing the Edwards heirs from ever obtaining what they see as their rightful inheritance. According to Edward Eyre's attorney, John Smarto, however, there could be a loophole.
The approach we're taking is completely different than any of the other approaches taken that I'm familiar with in the past 50 or 75 years. Our approach is to publicly get this story out there, force a political inquiry, just like what should have happened in the 1950s. The only way that we could do it is if we get these politicians to establish an inquiry, to pass a law, to allow these heirs, if it's found that Trinity Church was playing fast and loose with the law back then, and that they acquired these lands illegally, and if it's established, if that's the final conclusion to the inquiry, then, and only then, do I believe we can pursue somebody.
The Edwards story is certainly a modern epic, but it has taken quite a few sordid turns, and many people have been defrauded by hopes of a vast fortune. To Father Calloway, it's all an elaborate hoax.
There is this phenomenon known as fraudulent heirs, and it's a con game. Early immigrants to this country at the turn of the century were sold parts of the Brooklyn Bridge. There was the Brooklyn Bridge. It was handsome, it was strong, it was innovative, it was a very powerful symbol. And so people getting off the boat would buy shares in the Brooklyn Bridge, and of course the Brooklyn Bridge was owned by others and then owned by the city. The same's been true with Hall Edwards' confidence game, of people raising money out of a hope that there's some pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. There's a fair number of people who've gone to jail for mail fraud in the Hall Edwards saga. There have been a lot of interesting battles of money disappearing. That's the continuing bottom line of the case.
Even the current Edwards heirs have experienced fraud on a grand scale.
The organization raised by membership fee $1.5 million.
The story there is that when the organization was formed, you had a handful of individuals who contacted heirs, and they said, for $450, you can join our organization. We're going to examine everything that happened here with the Robert Edwards estate. We're going to employ all these professionals, and we're going to get this money for you.
But in 4 years, we discovered they did no research.
They bought expensive gifts. They had five or six automobiles. They would just write a check to themselves.
They misused the funds, using it for Disney World vacations, their own medical expenses, hunting trips. Some of the money was used for call girls, diamond rings for their wives, personal items like heating systems for their houses. This is what the money was used for.
But I think at the beginning of this thing, they probably wanted to do this. They probably wanted to research this estate and do it.
But once they got control of the finance, the temptation was far too much for them to resist.
At the end of the day, over 3.5 years, all the money had been gone and no one knew it. And then what was left was really nothing.
So that kind of put a stop to the research for the period of time trying to prosecute the people. The next court case or trial date set is for March 1st.
Whilst some of the Edwards heirs have undoubtedly been the victims of fraud, it hasn't diminished their enthusiasm. For many of the Edwards heirs, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow might not lie on the streets of Manhattan.
I think the fortune is meeting people from Wales. You feel they're as close to you as your own brother or sister. That's one of the treasures that I have found.
I've met a whole new family that I never, ever dreamt existed. And if this is proven, then I will have beaten Goliath.
We'll turn Manhattan into an Isle of Joy.
So as Cleoma Four stands on the streets of Manhattan and surveys what could be her real estate, what are her thoughts?
And after coming from Pennsylvania, the only thing that's in my mind, please get me out of here fast.
We'll turn Manhattan into an Isle of Joy.
The narrator was Ruth Terrett, and the readings were by Brendan Charlson. Manhattan Story was produced by Martin Kurzik.